spend the money. Come on, my honey, let's lend it, spend it, send it rolling around.
The movie business might be the only industry left that's still in the money. Box office profits surged by nearly 20% this year, despite the poor economy. With so many people flocking back to the movie theaters, we thought it might be a good idea to take a look at the movies that were made during a previous economic crisis. So on today's projection segment, the subject is Depression-era musicals. And the four films we've selected are Gold Diggers of 1933, 42nd Street, Footlight Parade, and Flying Down to Rio. I'd also like to remind our listeners that we still have seats open for our screening of Gold Diggers of 1933 tonight at the Galapagos Art Space in Brooklyn. You can go to our show page at WNYC.org for more information. Joining me now are Daniel Egan, author of America's Film Legacy, which is published by Continuum Books. He is also a critic at Film Journal. And also with us is Jonathan Kahana, an associate professor of film studies at NYU. I'm pleased to welcome both of them to the show today. Hello.
Thanks for having me.
Daniel, the first three musicals on our list, Gold Diggers of 33, 42nd Street, and Footlight Parade, were all Warner Brothers films. Do they have more in common than just the studio?
What do you mean? I mean, they were all basically the work of Daryl Zanuck, who was the chief of production for Warner Brothers at the time. But, you know, I'd like to correct a misconception about the Depression and its effect on Hollywood. At the time we're talking about, in 1933, the only studio that wasn't bankrupt or in receivership was MGM. So Warner Brothers was in really bad shape at this time. People think that the industry sort of survived the Depression intact, but they were barely hanging on.
Although they produced some of these films, which were rather lavish, so they must have been putting themselves into hock.
Well, part of the reason why the films were so elaborate was because they wanted to position themselves as a player in the studio. It was like conspicuous consumption for them. They wanted to show off their studio, their resources, and they wanted to throw a lot of money on the screen.
And did it work?
Yes. Well, 42nd Street was a huge hit for them. They it cost them about $500,000 to make, and it made millions of dollars for them.
Certain actors appear again and again. Dick Powell, Ruby Keeler, Joan Blundell, to a lesser extent Ginger Rogers, because she was also at RKO. Why those in particular?
They're the actors that Warner Brothers hired, and it's
were they the big stars at Warner's at the time?
They were becoming big stars at the time, and it's interesting because Warner Brothers was gearing their output towards a different audience than MGM or Paramount. They were gearing more towards a blue collar, lower class audience, and they're the kind of stars that they promoted.
Jonathan, were these films very different stylistically from the works? The films we were getting from other studios?
The films that Warner's, which thought of itself as the Ford of the movies in the period, were, I think you could say, stylistically different in that they had a kind of gritty realism, and that was something also that Zanuck promoted and was interested in drawing from the headlines of the times. And, you know, each studio had, to a certain extent, a particular house style. So, and this had something to do with trying to carve out a market niche as much as promoting certain political agendas or social agendas.
What about RKO, which we also associate with some of these musicals?
Yeah, RKO, my sense is the one studio it's harder to come up with a house style for. I mean, they were a kind of eclectic studio in terms of style. So one of the films that you're talking about, Flying Down to Rio, very lavish-looking musical in comparison to something like Gold Diggers or Footlight Parade.
RKO did a lot of austere Ginger Rogers films.
Yeah, I mean, one
with people
could,
in tuxedos.
Right, one could think of RKO as a kind of sophisticated European style studio, but they also made a number of melodramas. I mean, a number of films that didn't look anything like what we associate them with, the lavish images of Fred and Ginger.
Daniel, the films we are talking about were all made around the same time. Is the order in which they were released significant at all?
Sure. 42nd Street was really the first one, and it resuscitated resurrected the musical genre, because in the early 30s, the transition to sound, there was a glut of musicals, and they really destroyed the market for it. And for Zanuck to return to musicals was a big step for him to take. As a matter of fact, the Warner Brothers themselves hated musicals, and there's some indication that he tried to slip this past them as a backstage melodrama, and that they weren't even aware that it was going to be a musical. That's how out of favor they were. As a matter of fact, there were musicals where they had stripped the songs out of it so they could release them to the audience.
They hated musicals because they had certain political ideas?
I think it's because they were so awful, basically, most of them.
Most of the musicals.
And also they were...
But not these.
No, these are different, but these also were benefited from a new sound technology, a new film stock, so they could really... They looked and sounded a lot better than films from even just 2 years before.
Jonathan, all three of the Warner Brothers musicals we're talking about featured choreography by Busby Berkeley. For those in our audience who haven't seen his work, what kinds of elements go into a typical Busby Berkeley number?
Well, Berkeley was different, I would say, than many of the choreographers at the time because he was so interested in these very complicated numbers packed with personnel, which displayed a kind of mechanical monstrosity of the studio system. So at the same time that you would see these very graceful organizations of bodies, you would also see quite a bit of the mechanical working of the studio. I mean, the final number in Gold Diggers, I think, is a good example of this, where Berkeley masses bodies in these kind of tableaus of the returning veteran. But he also shows you how the stage works and how much labor it takes to put together a spectacle like that.
But it also is so unrealistic because they often take place in a theater, and there are all these special effects. There's snow. There are millions of people who seem to be dancing, and their lap dissolves.
Yeah, I love how he shows the orchestra pit before the number, as if this is actually occurring in a theater, and you've got the best seat for it. But you know his background.
And then we have all those overhead shots of the dancers doing all of making flower arrangements and other things. And
geometric
unless you were in the
patterns.
Balcony, you wouldn't have seen much of what was going on.
No, you know, his background was in choreographing parades and marching bands. So he wasn't really interested in dance per se. He wasn't interested in steps or routines. He had two approaches, the geometric patterns and then sort of these mini narratives, which were turning the songs into stories.
And he'd actually done that during World War I. He organized, he was a drill parade organizer. So you can see that militaristic organization.
And we get that in Gold Diggers and Forgotten Man, mm-hmm. which we may be able to play a little bit of later. Did people comment on the unrealistic aspect of it at the time, or did they just simply enjoy it?
Well, Otis Ferguson referred to the epic chutzpah of My Forgotten Man. So uh-huh. I think people were flabbergasted. A lot of people were flabbergasted by it.
Yeah, I mean, I think in some ways people didn't really know what to do with the artifice of those spectacles. And they also, as Daniel was saying, at the studio and both, I think, in criticism, weren't quite sure what the place of those musical numbers was supposed to be in the narrative, since they often interrupted the narrative and, other than being a backstage musical, had no real explanation in the narrative.
Well, you know, all these films were made well into the Depression. Do they reflect any political sentiments?
Well, only in the sense that Warner Brothers wanted to capitalize on their on supporting FDR, which is just like somebody putting a flag on their car today while they're thinking driving a gas guzzler is patriotic.
Forgotten Man is actually a phrase that he used in one of his speeches.
And they turn into pictograms of FDR and things like that. You know, what's interesting, when Berkeley started shooting Gold Diggers in 1933 on March 6th, 1933, which was the same day that the Motion Picture Academy imposed a 50% pay cut across the board in the Hollywood industry and froze salaries above $25 a week. This was not really what FDR was trying to do, but the Warner Brothers loved that. They couldn't get enough of that.
Jonathan, somebody has suggested that Busby Berkeley's choreography also suggests the benefits of working in unison.
Yeah, I mean, I would say...
It's almost a Stakhanovite image.
Yeah, I would say in some ways, just to go back to your previous question, that the choreography in some ways reflects in a kind of subtle way the political sentiment of the time, the sense that working in unison, sacrificing individual desires and individual needs to the needs of the collective might actually benefit both the individual and the collective.
My guests are Jonathan Gahana, associate professor of film studies at NYU, and Daniel Egan, who is a critic at Film Journal and author of America's Film Legacy. We're talking about Depression-era films, musicals, and the first one that we will take a deeper look at is 42nd Street. TMC, the Turner Movie Channel, recently named it one of the top 15 most influential films of all time.
Yikes.
We got that in just today. It's directed by Lloyd Bacon, Can you give us a quick synopsis of the plot, Jonathan?
Well, it's the kind of classic backstage musical plot. Putting on a show, and I would say the backstage element is steeped in the history of the Depression, insofar as the excuse for showing us how a show is put on is that the director, Julian Marsh, is on the verge of exhaustion. I mean, he is in some ways a kind of figure of this depressed male, out-of-energy worker.
We have a clip from 42nd Street where Warner Baxter, who plays Julian Marsh, explains why he needs to get back into the business of putting on shows. Let's take a listen.
Say, these days, stars like Dorothy Brock are a dime a dozen.
That's what we got you for, Julian. Julian Marsh, the greatest musical comedy director in America today.
What do you mean, today?
All right, tomorrow, too. Say, with your reputation...
Did you ever try to cash your reputation at a bank? I'm in this for one reason only. Money.
Money? You? Say, with all the hits you've had, you ought to be worth plenty.
Yeah, I ought to be, but I'm not. Did you ever hear of Wall Street?
No, I'm not going to comment on the acting there, but that really must have resonated with audiences. Hadn't much of Broadway's market collapsed by 1933, Daniel?
Broadway was in bad shape at that time. They paid a lot of money to get Warner Baxter to do this film. But, you know, the point that is hidden in this is that he says he's only in it for the money, but the movie is telling you ultimately he's in it for the art and for the glory of getting a new star on the stage.
Well, Jonathan, these musicals are often described as a kind of escapism, but aren't many of the plots about people trying to find or hold on to their jobs?
Sure. I mean, I think, you know, starting with 42nd Street and starting with the figure of Julian Marsh, who is trying to find a way to claw back to stability, if not prosperity, by working hard. And then everybody under him is in some ways in the same position.
Did all of these Warner Brothers films do well at the box office?
Tremendously well, although they had decreasing returns as they pounded the formula into the ground. They ended up making another three Gold Diggers sequels after the one in 1933.
Well, let's talk about Footlight Parade, which was also directed by Lloyd Bacon. Can you give us a quick rundown of what happens in that film?
Footlight Parade is actually based on a real production company, Fanchon and Corso, I think was the name of it, that made tab shows, which were these little prologues that could travel around from theater to theater. And in the Footlight Parade, James Cagney plays one of the producers of the tab shows, and it's all about how he's beset by incompetent performers, corrupt producers, and how difficult it is to create something every day.
We tend to forget that James Cagney began as a song and dance man.
Yes, and he was chafing at the bit to get this part. He was angry at playing two-bit gangsters and people hit girls all the time. He really wanted to dance. He started as a dancer. And I think he brings an energy to this film that's missing from the other two. It's just spectacular watching him work.
But isn't this movie really about how the movies are destroying musicals?
Yes, isn't that interesting?
That's ironic, isn't it?
Ironically, they put Fanchon out of business as a result of this. But that's what Warner Brothers was doing with their Vitaphone shorts, too. Once they filmed a vaudeville performer and a novelty act in a short, that vaudeville performer's act was ruined. He couldn't go anywhere then.
Let's play a clip from Footlight Parade where James Cagney gets into an argument with the censor about a new routine that's being put together.
I got bad news for you, Chester. You can't use the cat idea.
Oh, you're going to start to tell me what I can use and what I can't
use? Well, it's my job to see that our prologues fit in with the censor regulations. I'm only doing my duty.
Oh, I see. The tomcats and the pussycats are all right, but the kittens are illegitimate.
They certainly are.
Unless they're married by a preacher cat. No preacher cat, no kittens.
No, you can't use it in 39 cities.
Uh-huh. Well, I've got some bad news for you. You're fired.
That's rather sharp satire, Jonathan. Wasn't this movie released shortly before the production code of 1934 went into effect? Is this a kind of a way that Hollywood is saying, we don't like this?
Well, I think it's a kind of having its cake and eating it too moment where Hollywood says, we can gently satirize the code, but we know we're going to have to work with it.
Although there's reference to cities that had codes. So one of the reasons for even making this code is to eliminate the fact that they had to worry about Boston and Dallas and New York and Chicago, each with a different code.
And also to worry about the police departments in those places where prior to 1927, quite a bit of the censorship activity was taking place.
Exactly. And, you know, the end joke there is they made F. Hugh Herbert, the censor, who's famous for his notoriously smutty plays and performances. So that was their little dig.
Well, the next movie we'll talk about, Gold Diggers of 1933, has a number in it that is about as sexy as you could ever want a song to be. Let's play a little bit of Pettin' in the Park.
Pettin' in the park.
Bad boy.
Pettin' in the dark. Bad girl. First you pet a little, let off a little, then you get a little kiss. Pettin' on the sly.
Oh, my.
Act a little shy. Oh, why? Struggle just a little, then hug a little, cuddle up and whisper this.
That's rather sexually explicit.
Well, and it's even more,
and you wind up with a little kid.
And it's even more exciting if you can see the images at that moment, because one of the things the production code of 1930 was specifically outlawing, one could say, was diaphanous clothing. And you see at a certain point diaphanous clothing, which allows actors to appear, actresses in particular, to appear nude.
Well, we see them in silhouette in the nude, don't we?
Yes,
or
we
what
do.
Looks like to be the nude.
Yes, we do. And when you put a sopping wet Ruby Keeler in a tin can and then give Dick Powell a can opener, I think the audiences at the time understood fully well how sexual the material was.
Yeah, I mean, I would say it, understood and then maybe even didn't understand how much pleasure they got from this perverse image of Dick Powell sawing up the back of what was supposed to be a metal corset on the body of Ruby Keeler.
Yes, I'm still trying to figure out what Billy Barty is doing there.
Well, what is this plot is a little different from the other two, isn't it?
Yeah, it's based on a very famous play, actually, a 1919 play that was produced by David Belasco, and that the Warner Brothers had filmed twice before already. And when Zanuck started filming it before they released 42nd Street, and Zanuck said, just keep it the same as the 1929 version, so you can actually find corresponding roles between the two film versions.
But it's also different, I think, because women and women's intelligence is at the center of the plot. And we see this in the other Warner Brothers musicals of the period, but
and
not
in
to
their
this
dramas,
extent.
And their dramas, too, because Three in a Match is basically Gold Diggers of 1933 without music.
Well, the film opens with chorus girls singing We're in the Money, but the song also includes a weird thing, a real oddity, and maybe we can take a little listen to that.
Here we in hay the honey may. He way out gaily, out way up, way out way, and we still did gaily on well.
That's Ginger Rogers singing We're in the Money in Pig Latin. Do we know how that got into the, well, that couldn't have been in the script.
Well, the story I've read is that Ginger Rogers was fooling around on the set and was actually singing some of the lyric in Pig Latin, and Berkeley heard this and said, why don't we try to work that into the number?
Now, he wasn't the director. How much input did he actually have in the final production of a film?
You know what's fascinating is that they shot separate sound stages. The dramatic director, Lloyd Bacon or Mervyn LeRoy, whoever, filmed all the dramatic material first, and then Berkeley took over in a different stage and did all the musical numbers.
And I think that Pig Latin moment is also, it's another one of those moments we were talking about where the movies try to incorporate some theatrical forms. So I think there's a gesture there as well to the history of vaudeville or burlesque.
How did Ginger Rogers wind up in the film? She was a star at RKO at the time, wasn't she?
Not really. She was sort of a ringer, though. She was in 42nd Street as well, and she got paid more than anybody, any of the other dancers in 42nd Street. She was a Broadway star. She had been in short movies like Office Blues. She was starting to record. And she had an incredibly driven stage mother who didn't mind having her daughter play loose woman.
And it's fascinating to watch her characters change as she gets more and more integrated into the RKO style. And when she makes the shift with Flying Down to Rio, her character's quite a bit like, it's a sort of fast-talking dame in the way that it is in the Warner Brothers musicals. But the further she gets into the Fred and Ginger musicals, the more sophisticated, the more middle class she gets.
And we'll talk about Flying Down to Rio next, but I want to remind our listeners that my guests are Jonathan Kahana, Associate Professor of Film Studies at NYU, and film historian Daniel Egan, who also works as a critic at Film Journal. So let's talk about RKO's Flying Down to Rio. This is totally different from the Warner Brothers. Could this have even been made at Warner Brothers?
I don't think they would try to make it there. What I find really fascinating about it is that they wanted to make a musical Lou Brock, Hal Brock, I believe, was the producer. And they couldn't get it by Marion C. Cooper unless they added things that, who was the, Marion C. Cooper was the head of production at the time, unless they added things that would appeal to him, which is why they set it in South America, and which is why they made it about aviation, because Cooper was on the board of directors of Pan American.
But it seems totally oblivious to the fact that it's being filmed during the Depression.
Yeah, except, I mean, I would
this
say...
This is 1933.
The thing that I think demonstrates some awareness of the political changes and the social changes of the Depression is that the state or government is represented in the film as entirely corrupt, something that one has to work outside of. So you can sort of place that film against the trust of government or the trust of management or managerial work that you see in the Warner Brothers films.
So this was an anti-FDR film on some level?
I think on some, I guess
critical
I would say,
of the New Deal?
I would say suspicious of the New Deal, or more explicitly suspicious than some of the other studios films.
It ends with girls dancing on planes in this big number, choreographed by Hermes Pan. How do you think it compares with the Busby Berkeley routines?
Well, it was really, Hermes suggested certain things. He wasn't actually the choreographer at that point. But they, again, were appealing to Cooper's love of juvenile adventure. He loved death-defying feats, and what could be more death-defying than dancing on a wing?
But it seems almost like it's kind of one-up Busby Berkeley in some ways.
Yeah, I mean, it's so much more awkward, I think, than the Berkeley numbers. To me, the most interesting part of that final number is the long preparation, strapping the women onto the airplane. That's much more interesting than the quite awkward musical number that's supposed to take place in the skies above.
Am I to read anything into them strapping those women onto the plane?
I think you can read whatever you would. I think there are many possible readings of
yes,
the meaning of it.
There's an awful lot of erotic subtext in these films, isn't there?
It's not that subtextual. I think it's right out there in the open.
Despite the fact that we have a code and a new code coming in. So what do you think these movies tell us about the Great Depression, if anything?
The thing that especially I think Gold Diggers tells us is that the Great Depression is going to be, for better and worse, a kind of disruption or intervention into the lives of ordinary people. And, you know, I think you see that in the structure of the films, in the way in which the films are all about these sort of interruptions and inversions and forms of irony that people have to reinvent themselves in.
Have you thought about the kinds of movies that have been made during other economic crises? Since the one we're in right now is being compared with the Depression, the worst since the Depression, I'm not hearing about any musicals in the works, but
no.
are we seeing a similar kind of so-called escapist fare?
Well, if you call comic books escapists, you're seeing a lot of comic books now, aren't you?
Yeah. I mean, I would say in some ways what we think of as somewhat smaller films, I mean, a film like The Wrestler or a film even smaller in scale of production, Kelly Reichardt's Wendy and Lucy, these are, I think, the contemporary versions of those attempts at the very outset of the Depression to make a film that responds to social conditions.
So Wendy and Lucy is kind of Sullivan's Travels for today?
Well, I think it's Sullivan's Travels without any of the irony or
humor.
Or humor, but with the same kind of...
they're both good films, but we must say Sullivan's Travels is one of the great films of Hollywood history.
And Sullivan's Travels, I think, looks back at the Depression as something which is now behind us. And I think Wendy and Lucy and The Wrestler both look towards a coming tragedy of economic and social forms.
Although the superhero films are not unique to this situation, they started popping up as real crowd pleasers after 9/11, didn't they?
Well, they've always been a mainstay of Hollywood films. You can go back to silent serials for superhero and heroines. So Hollywood's always leaned on them, yes.
I think we want to end with A Taste of Forgotten Man from Gold Diggers of 1933, which we are screening tonight at 7:30 at the Galapagos Art Space in Brooklyn, and I invite listeners to visit our show page at WNYC.org for more information and to RSVP because a few seats are still available. My great thanks to my two guests, Daniel Egan, author of America's Film Legacy, which is published by Continuum Books. You can also read his criticism in Film Journal, and Jonathan Kahana, who's an associate professor of film studies at NYU. And here is something from Gold Diggers.
far away, you shouted hip hooray, but look at him today. Remember my forgotten man. You had him cultivate the land. He walked behind the plow, the sweat fell from his brow.